previously on the storyteller Naked Villainy. Insults are directed at an expert witness.
Sherlock Holmes, Hercule Poirot and CSI all rolled into one.
The defence accuses the police of tunnel vision, hell-bent on charging Kit Harrison.
Operation Clarity was designed to point the finger at Christopher Harrison.
And he quotes Spider-Man to the jury.
As with everything else, such power brings great responsibility.
It's taken 45 years to bring a killer to court. And for the first time in UK history, you'll hear the full murder trial and witness justice being done. It was a brutal murder of a brilliant woman who was a rising star in genetic research.
It would now be almost like a script from Morse. The investigators swarming over the dreaming spires of university land.
There was kind of palpable feeling of evil in the air.
I was told it was just a mass of blood in here.
2 decades on from confronting evil.
So did you kill your ex-wife Brenda Page?
Evil is being confronted by the law.
Did you kill her?
No.
She knew it was coming.
He said he was going to kill her.
If he killed her, he would do it so that nobody would know.
Will his true nature be unmasked?
Are you familiar with the tale of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde?
And can Brenda's own words help secure her killer's fate?
A letter of a death foretold.
This is The Storyteller, Naked Villainy, written, produced and edited by me, Isla Traquair. I was getting ready in my pale blue teenage bedroom for the final day in court. It felt oddly right to be back living with my parents 2 decades on while covering this court case. I now have a dog, some wrinkles, and a roller coaster or two of life experience since I began working on this case in my early 20s. Before I left that morning, I decided to watch the full playback of my confrontation with Kit Harrison in Holland, which you heard a snippet of at the beginning of the series. I'd had it on my hard drive prior to this, but this was the moment I chose to see it for the first time in 20 years.
So it's March 9th. Early. I barely slept and I've been awake since about 5 o'clock this morning and I'm feeling really nervous about today and I'm just about to watch back the moment I confronted him 20 years ago in Leiden and I'm standing, you can see me, I'm standing outside of People Carrier and we've been sat there for 2 days and we saw someone coming out of the building and I'm basically waiting for him to turn up, to come outside and then basically ambush him. But I'm just going to have a watch back of it now. I'm kind of hiding behind the car at this moment.
Mr. Harrison? Mr. Harrison? Mr. Harrison? We're from Grampian Television. We'd like to talk to you about the murder of your ex-wife, Brenda Page. Many people believe you're responsible, Mr. Harrison. Did you kill her? Mr. Harrison, there was an interim interdict about out against you because you threatened her with violence. Did you kill Brenda Page? Did you kill your ex-wife, Mr. Harrison? It's a simple question. Mr. Harrison, answer the question. Did you kill your ex-wife, Brenda Page?
I'm running now, chasing after him.
Watch the car. There's a car behind you. Like, go. Mr. Harrison, we're asking you a simple question. Did you kill your ex-wife, Brenda Page? Why in the 25 years since her murder have you not once been in touch with the police to ask how the inquiry was going, seeing as you were so clearly in love with her and obsessed with her, Mr. Harrison? Mr. Harrison, why are you being so evasive?
He keeps twisting and turning every time I go towards him. Does not look happy. So now we're going into woods. Down
Mr.
a pathway.
Harrison, she'd be 58 now. Do you think about her much?
running along a pathway beside some water and woods.
Mr. Harrison, it's a simple question. Why can't you talk to us? Why are you not taking this opportunity to protest your innocence, Mr. Harrison?
He's going through bushes now. He's cut through bushes and is running away from us, basically. God, I'm ballsy. I'm impressed with myself.
Mr. Harrison, why aren't you taking this opportunity to protest your innocence?
He's just going back and forth in the bushes. I'm out of breath, clearly.
Mr. Harrison, why aren't you taking this opportunity to protest your innocence?
I'm frost, Ellen, aren't you? Mania?
Yeah?
I'm frost. Ik ben lastig gevallen door deze mensen. Wilt u een getuige zijn? Ze vallen mij ontzettend lastig. Ik kan nergens daarheen. Ze zitten alleen maar stomme vragen. Ze zijn fantastisch.
Ik kan u niet helpen.
Helemaal niet van.
Ik kan u helaas niet helpen.
Ik wandel met u mee naar de hinder. Dan bent u de getuige.
He's basically saying they're harassing me. And he's walking with this man. Now we find this man later and we said, is he Dutch or is he English? And he said, no, he's English. He's going back towards his building. I'm cutting through bushes to try and cut him off. He's not running, he's taking pretty big strides.
Why won't you talk to us? Take this opportunity.
And he goes back inside his building. The door opening. Door closing. Do you know, I remember the adrenaline that was pumping through me chasing after him. Ooh, I haven't seen that, the unedited, in a long time. And yeah, my heart's pumping now just watching it. It's obviously, you know, it's the same man, but this is 20 years ago and he looks like such a younger man. And now he's 82, so he would have been 62 in this. I've actually, it's frozen in a frame where he's about to go through a door and he's just turning back. You can see him through the window. He's just staring at us. And there's a woman in the reflection of the window with dogs watching us as well. And, oof. Yeah, that was an intense moment.
I drove to the city and picked up journalist Alison Shaw on the way. We were both nervous.
I barely slept. How are you feeling this morning?
Oh, a bit of turmoil, to be honest. I woke up this morning and I thought, I curse that not proven verdict in Scotland, just in case that's used as a cop-out.
Mm-hmm.
Because I could see why they wouldn't want to give a not guilty verdict. But I can also see why there might be a division in the jury and we might not get a guilty. And I thought, oh, well, they'll just use not proven, you know. Leaves a slight stain on a character, but it's very unsatisfactory for our family. So, and then I started going over everything in my head again and I thought, no, I believe everything the advocate deputy said.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't like the attitude of the defence KC, although he clearly was doing his job very well.
He did an amazing job, actually, from when we chatted at lunchtime to then the remainder of his speech. Mm-hmm. I'm like, oh wow, you know, he did an amazing job. He did the best job you possibly could.
He did, and there was a good sort of line at the end of it. He said, the death of Brenda Page is a real tragedy, a word that's often overused in these courts. do not, ladies and gentlemen, compound that tragedy by convicting Dr. Harrison on this hodgepodge of gossip, storytelling, innuendo, and what would now be called fake news.
Mm.
I mean, I can see he's trying to bring the case up to the 21st yeah. century, you know, but I just thought, no. I just disagreed with that. These are words will be ringing in their ears, you know.
Because he has the last word. He's
yes,
the last say.
Yeah. But he says, but whether you decide the evidence is wholly unconvincing, deeply unsatisfying, or you just don't know. And that's the question. You just don't know. The just result here is a verdict that acquits Dr. Harrison. He didn't say that finds him not guilty.
Yeah.
He said that acquits.
Mm-hmm. I felt he was really leaning into the beyond reasonable doubt, leaning into the law. Like, if, and also just the psychology of, if any of you, you know, speak up. If there's something you're sure of, speak up.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But I think he did manage to sort of wind them in knots, possibly, with naming this person and naming that person.
Yeah.
And it got really confusing.
I was kind of sorry that Brenda Page's character and reputation was sullied again because his whole case revolves around the fact that she was actually just vindictively making up all these allegations of violence in order to get a divorce, and I don't believe that.
Yeah, I saw her nephew and his wife. It was not appropriate to, you know, pull out a microphone at that point, but they were really upset, and they said, you know,
I noticed that, yeah.
Yeah, and they said, you know, it's just horrendous to hear, you know, the whole family, they're such a kind, gentle,
mm-hmm.
they're not drama queens, they're not this, they're not that.
Yeah.
And then they said, that is the last time anyone will ever say anything bad about her.
Oh, really?
And I thought, that's a powerful, you know, it's a horrible thing to go through, but it's over now. But it has made them worried. And
mm-hmm.
I think everyone is a bit like, I thought, okay, they'll get their direction this morning, they'll go away, but I think their minds will already be made up, but I think they're going to have cause to ponder at least.
Well, they've had overnight to think about both the speeches, which can be a good thing,
mm-hmm.
but then they're going to get the direction from the jury, the judge, and he's obviously going to mention there are three verdicts you can return, and that might put the cat among the pigeons. I don't know. It's that thing, you know, if you ask yourself if there's some issue in your life and you have a reasonable doubt, then that's the sort of doubt you have to act on.
I think there's a doubt with everything. Even if you feel like, I want to do that, there's always something holding us back, a little internal voice of niggling or whatever it might be.
Yeah.
Do I really want to have a cheese sandwich or tuna? Well, I think I want cheese. Yeah, I'm going to go for the cheese. And if someone said to me, are you, you know, beyond reasonable doubt that cheese sandwich is the right, you'd probably get me to say no. So
and then you'd be annoyed, you should have had a tuna one.
Exactly. I know that's a ridiculous analogy, but it
almost as ridiculous as the 30,000 people going to Hampden convinced that Scotland was going to win the World Cup and then realising it had all been for nothing in the analogy of the defence.
That was bizarre.
Yeah.
I get where he was going with it, but I'm not quite sure if it landed the way he'd hoped, but...
Well, a lot of them won't know who Ally MacLeod even was.
No, they weren't alive.
Especially if they were female and not born in 1978 and not a football fan.
Yeah.
I just thought that was very odd and said more about him than anything else.
Yeah. I feel sick. But let's go.
Yeah, it's that horrible moment.
It's just the dread. And even when you feel quite confident that they're going to return the verdict, which, you know, we... always having heard evidence we think we'd be right, whether it's guilty or not guilty, there's always, when they come back in, that feeling, there's nothing like it, is it?
It's an extraordinary, it's a fear, really. It's you can't really describe it, no. It's and God knows what it must be like for somebody sitting in the dock, especially if they're actually innocent.
Yeah,
and I don't know what it must be like for the jury to come back, but you know, they always say if the jury comes back and they don't look at the accused, he's guilty.
Yeah.
We shall see.
They've been pretty poker-faced, so...
Mm-hmm.
Yes, right. Let's into the breach
once more. Let's just hope this is the day.
Let's hope it's the day.
Yeah.
Or I'll be having this conversation again with you tomorrow.
Stepping away for just a brief moment while I check in with you all and ask you, how is your social battery? What does that mean? Well, do you feel drained, bursting with energy, or something in between? Episode sponsor BetterHelp is here to provide you with support in figuring that out and how you can become your best self. I don't know about you, but I tend to hibernate over the winter months, and now that spring is sort of here, it takes a change of gear to get in socialising again. Therapy isn't just for something traumatic. It can help you have a better awareness of how you're feeling, setting boundaries, knowing when it's good to say yes, and when you need to say no. And you owe it to yourself to take an hour each week to talk to someone. BetterHelp's 1,000+ therapists are available at the touch of a button. Whether it's a call from your laptop or smartphone, or even texts, you can engage when and how it works best for you. All you need to do is fill out a questionnaire on their website, and you'll be matched with a therapist best suited to your needs. Working on your mental health is just as important as daily exercise or a gym routine. A healthy mind is a healthy life. It's so easy to sign up. I've done it myself, and you don't need a referral. And with a special code just for you listeners, you'll receive 10% off the first month. Just go to betterhelp.com/storyteller. That's betterhelp.com/storyteller.
Court. Well, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. It's now my task to give you the legal directions which you must apply when considering your verdict.
Giving legal direction to the jury is the most important role of a judge in a jury trial. If they fail to mention something, it could provide grounds for an appeal if an accused is found guilty. Judge Lord Richardson was meticulous and fair. Despite being far younger than most judges and with a much kinder face than some of the older, stern ones I've encountered, Lord Richardson was a safe pair of hands. What you didn't hear throughout the series was his interactions with every single witness. It would have taken too long to include, but you'll remember how he spoke with Dr. Harrison, ensuring he was comfortable and could hear, etc. He began by repeating the explanation of the roles they all have to play. He would give them the legal framework for assessing the evidence, but they alone were responsible for the evidence and facts. He was going to take them through 5 chapters: general principles, particular rules of evidence relevant to this case, specific legal direction of the indictment, the Crown case and the defence case, and how to approach matters in the jury room. Point 1 included the fact that accused are presumed innocent until proven guilty in Scotland, and the burden of proof is entirely on the Crown. The accused has no obligation to give evidence, but because in this case Dr. Harrison had, they would include that in their considerations. Next, he went on to the standard of proof and the hard-to-explain beyond reasonable doubt.
The standard of proof which the Crown requires to achieve is a high one. The Crown must satisfy you of the guilt of the accused beyond reasonable doubt. And those words mean what they say. A reasonable doubt is not some fanciful or speculative or far-fetched doubt, but one based on reason. The Crown does not require to prove its case to a scientific or a mathematical certainty, because that would plainly be impossible when dealing with human affairs. Beyond reasonable doubt is sometimes described as the sort of doubt that would make you pause and think again before making an important decision in the practical conduct of your own lives. It's more than a suspicion of guilt, more even than a probability of guilt. This doesn't mean that every fact has to be proved beyond reasonable doubt. What it means is that looking at the evidence as a whole, you have to be satisfied of the guilt of the accused on the charge he faces beyond reasonable doubt. If you have such a doubt, your duty is to give the benefit of it to the accused and to acquit him. Equally, if you have no such doubt, your duty will be to convict. So when I speak of the Crown establishing or proving anything, or you, the jury, being satisfied about something, it is proof beyond reasonable doubt that I always have in mind.
He said another fundamental rule is a person cannot be convicted on the evidence of one person alone, no matter how credible. There must be corroboration from more than one source, separate and independent sources, pointing to the guilt of the accused.
Corroboration does not mean that every single fact has to be spoken to by two or more witnesses. It doesn't mean that every aspect of a charge has to be spoken to by two or more witnesses. What it means is that it's only the essential facts which require to be spoken to by at least two witnesses or from at least two independent sources of evidence. The essential facts are, as I've said, that a crime as defined in law was committed and the identification of the accused as the perpetrator of that crime. Now, the evidence or the sources of evidence do not require to come from eyewitnesses. Sometimes evidence of great weight can come from indirect sources, in other words, circumstantial evidence. And I'm going to say a bit more about circumstantial evidence in my next chapter. But whatever the source and type of evidence, the Crown may not seek a conviction and you cannot convict an accused unless you accept the evidence from two separate and independent sources on the two essential facts. Now, these rules that I've been going over, the burden of proof, the standard of proof, and corroboration, they only apply to the Crown case. They do not apply to the defence. In this case, Dr. Harrison lodged a special defence of alibi, and that was read to you, you may remember, at the start of the trial, and you have a copy of it. The only purpose of a special defence is to give notice to the Crown that a particular line of defence may be taken. It doesn't take away from the accused's stance that he is not guilty. It doesn't take away from the requirement on the Crown to prove the case against the accused beyond reasonable doubt. The defence do not need to lead evidence in support of it. They don't need to prove it to any particular standard. You just consider any evidence relating to it, along with all the rest of the evidence. If it's believed, or if it raises a reasonable doubt, an acquittal must result. In this case, Dr. Harrison is saying that at the time the crime was committed, he was not there. Hence, he was not the perpetrator. It's for the Crown to meet that defence and to satisfy you beyond reasonable doubt that it should be rejected. To support that, the defence rely on Dr. Harrison's evidence. On the other hand, the Crown challenge that evidence and say when you consider all the circumstances of the case, you should be satisfied beyond reasonable doubt that Dr. Harrison was the perpetrator. You should look at all the evidence and consider the evidence in respect of the alibi and then decide if the Crown has proved guilt beyond reasonable doubt. I will come back both to the Crown case and to Dr. Harrison's case in the fourth chapter of my directions. Now, in relation to Dr. Harrison's evidence, there was absolutely no obligation on him to go into the witness box and give evidence. He had no burden of proof on him. He denied the charge against him. His position was, as I understood it, that he was kind, considerate, and gentle to Brenda. He denied that he had been with her on the night of the 13th of July through to the morning of the 14th of July 1978. He was emphatic that he did not murder Brenda Page. If his position is accepted by you, or if it raises a reasonable doubt in respect of the charge, you would acquit. Even if you entirely rejected the position of Dr. Harrison, that does not help the Crown. It's not a competition in that sense. The burden of proof means that you still need to be satisfied of the guilt of the accused on the charge beyond reasonable doubt on the Crown evidence. So if any piece of evidence raises a reasonable doubt, wherever it comes from, you should acquit the accused. Now, your task is to assess the evidence which you've heard from all the witnesses in the case. It's for you to decide if their evidence is truthful or untruthful, and if it's accurate or mistaken. And as you'll appreciate, these are two rather different things. A person may be attempting to tell the truth as they see it, or they may be lying. And that's what we describe as credibility. And in that situation, the question you'd ask yourselves is the witness being honest? But an honest witness may be doing their best to tell the truth, but may nevertheless be mistaken in some way. That is what we describe as reliability. And the question you'd ask yourselves in that situation is the witness right or wrong? Am I prepared to accept the witness's evidence as accurate and as something in which I can place trust? A good example of demonstrating the difference between credibility and reliability is an example unrelated to this case, where a witness might be telling the truth that he saw a black dog about 100 yards away. But due to poor eyesight, the animal may have been, in fact, a white cat. And therefore, albeit the witness was absolutely credible, he was not reliable on this matter. In undertaking these assessments, there are various ways in which you can, if you wish, test a witness's evidence. You'd be entitled to consider the demeanour of the witness, and by that I mean the way the witness gave their evidence, their body language, their tone of voice, the manner in which they answered the questions which were put to them. What sort of impression did the witness make on you? How did the witness come across to you? How did the evidence of the witness stand up when tested in cross-examination? Were there inconsistencies in their evidence? How does the witness's evidence square with the other evidence in the case? Is there an absence of evidence to support a witness's account? Is there evidence from another source or sources which supports their evidence? Have the accounts of the witnesses been consistent from the outset, or are there inconsistencies in their prior accounts? You need not consider a witness's evidence in isolation. You can test what a witness has said against other evidence in the case, and you can reject a piece of evidence precisely because it's not consistent with other evidence which you do accept. If the differences that arise are simply matters of detail, then they may not matter. But if they're on important issues, then you will have to decide which of the witnesses, if any, you accept, or whether that impacts on any view that you take of a particular witness. It's entirely a matter for you. There may be the effect of the passage of time affecting a witness's recollection of what occurred. Some witnesses have a good memory of past events, some not so good. In this case, for obvious reasons, this is a factor which you will have to consider carefully in your assessment of the evidence. Or, of course, a witness may simply be telling you lies and therefore different from the other witnesses for that reason. In assessing evidence, ladies and gentlemen, you may ask yourselves, does a witness have a motive for lying, or is a witness independent with no real axe to grind? More generally, you are entitled to test the evidence of a witness in light of your common sense, both individually and collectively, and your own experiences of life.
He repeated the point about it being what evidence they accept or reject and the weight they give parts of the evidence. They are judges, not detectives, and they cannot fill in the gaps with guesswork. If the counsel's recollection of the evidence differs from theirs, then it's their recollection that's important.
If you should feel that I formed a view of the evidence or the case, then you should ignore it. I haven't formed any such view. But in any event, any view of mine would be neither here nor there. It's your view which matters, and it's not for me to influence you in reaching your verdict. Nor should you be influenced by any thoughts of what the consequences will be for the accused in the event of a conviction. Your verdict, whatever it is, will have consequences for someone. But you should not let these influence you. Matters of sentence on the charge in the event of any guilty verdict are for me, and you cannot be influenced by the consequence on the accused of any guilty verdict. So you should put the consequence of your verdict, whatever it may be, out of your mind. You should also not be swayed or influenced by any feelings of disapproval or sympathy that may have been evoked by the evidence that you heard in the case. As was mentioned during the speeches, this is not a court of morals. It is a court of law. If you have any such feelings, you should put those out of your minds. Your duty is to exercise a cool, clinical, and unprejudiced judgment, to try this case dispassionately and in accordance with your oath, to try the accused on the evidence and the evidence alone.
The second chapter was on the types of evidence: direct evidence, which is eyewitness or it happened to them, and indirect or circumstantial evidence, which is facts and circumstances when taken together may amount to a solid core of evidence which may connect the accused to the crime or exculpate them. So, basic facts which, when taken together, the jury is asked to draw a conclusion which could establish a further fact. So in isolation, it may establish very little, but when taken together, it may combine and cohere evidence. He said circumstantial evidence can be just as convincing and reliable as direct evidence. He then said it's the answers and not the questions the jury must pay attention to. Questions asked to witnesses are not evidence, nor as suggestions or propositions, unless the witness agrees with the statement. He also said that the speeches by counsel are not evidence. Next, he moved on to prior statements. The first use of a prior statement is to jog memories. Second is if they forget details and are asked to look at their prior statement, and then they have to answer yes to two things. First, yes, I said that. And secondly, yes, it is true. Then it becomes adopted. Adoption of a statement doesn't mean it's credible or reliable. The jury still have to assess that themselves. The third use is to contradict what a witness has said in court. But the statement, if not adopted, is not evidence of the truth of what's in it. It can only be used to help the jury assess with the witness's credibility and reliability. That basically means if the witness says, "No, I didn't say that," the jury cannot accept that the evidence in the statement is true, because, for example, a policeman may have made a mistake, but they can use that fact to assess whether the witness is credible and reliable.
You'll have to decide whether there were any contradictions or inconsistencies between the prior police statements and what was said in evidence. And if there were, you'll have to consider how significant you consider those to be. In considering the uses made of prior statements in this case, you should bear in mind that the parties have agreed in paragraph 9 of the second joint minute that when counsel put police statements or parts of statements to witnesses, the words had been accurately recorded at the time by the police as having been said by the witnesses. That's what's recorded in paragraph 9. And I'll come back to the joint minutes and how you should deal with them in a moment. You should also, when thinking about the use of prior police statements, think about the points and consider the points made by both the Advocate Deputy and Mr. McConachy in their speeches to you yesterday in relation to this. Now, to turn to another evidential rule, which has application in this case. As I told you in my introductory remarks, the law regulates hearsay evidence. And by hearsay evidence, I mean what a witness tells you was said by someone else. As I explained at the outset, the general rule is that hearsay evidence is not allowed as evidence. However, as I also told you at the beginning of the trial, there are a number of exceptions to this rule. First, an exception to the hearsay rule, which is relevant in this case, is that you heard examples of what a witness says they heard someone say in order to explain the witness's state of knowledge or why they did something, and that is allowable. Second, you have heard a number of statements which people had previously made to the police, being read out by the, in most cases, now retired police officer who had taken the statements.
Lord Richardson listed the names of the retired officers and the names of the deceased whose statements they read out. He also mentioned video of Mr. Burt. The reading of the statements is hearsay, he explained, and that's not normally allowed in court, but one of the exceptions to the rule is when the person is dead. But the jury still needed to decide if the statements were credible and reliable, and what importance the information had. And they had to do this without seeing the person, hearing their voice, the opportunity to assess their body language in the witness box, and importantly, no option to be challenged during cross-examination.
Now, a number of the statements which you heard read out also included what those witnesses said they remembered the deceased Brenda Page saying. And you also heard what a number of other witnesses said they remembered Brenda Page saying. Now again, this is hearsay. But again, as with the evidence of the deceased witnesses I've mentioned, this evidence is admissible in the circumstances of this case. However, again, you need to be satisfied that Brenda Page did say what each of these witnesses said they remembered her saying. If you are so satisfied, then you can take account of this evidence of what Brenda Page said as evidence of the facts. But you also have to decide if what Brenda Page was remembered as having said is credible and reliable. Evidence being given about what she remembered as having said is, of course, different from her having given evidence herself in court. It's evidence, again, second hand, and you will have to decide what weight to give to it. You should remember this in judging the credibility and reliability of what she said. It wasn't given under oath, it wasn't the subject of cross-examination. Of course, you've not seen Brenda Page give this evidence, and so you cannot assess her as a witness in the way that you would assess a witness who gave evidence in court. As with any piece of evidence, whether directly or indirectly given, you can compare what Brenda Page is said to have said with the other evidence in the case and judge whether it fits with that or not. And you can decide what effect consistencies or inconsistencies have. You can also take into account what other evidence may tell you about the sort of person Brenda Page was. That may bear on the credibility and reliability of her evidence, and you should consider carefully what was said about this in the speeches that you heard yesterday. If you decide that any of the statements which Brenda Page is said to have made is credible and reliable, it's then part of the evidence in the case, and you then have to consider what weight or significance to attach to it.
He said the same could be said for the witnesses repeating something that the accused had told them. He said Dr. Harrison's answers during his police interview did form part of the evidence and reminded them that he had no obligation to speak. They must assess all witnesses, including the accused, in the same way. Next, he moved on to expert witnesses, people who are qualified in a specialist area. Normally, witnesses speak to fact and not their opinion, but expert witnesses can offer their opinion of their specialist knowledge. Again, the jury must make their own assessments of the expert witnesses. With regards to the two joint minutes, he said they are not evidence, they must be treated as fact, because the Crown and defence had agreed the information was established and proved.
Now, following the Advocate Depute withdrawing charges 1, 2, 3 and 5 on Thursday at the close of the Crown case, there is one charge remaining before you for verdict. That is charge 4, the charge of murder. However, it's important that you appreciate that you're still entitled to consider the evidence which was led in respect of the charges which have been withdrawn. In reaching your verdict, you should consider all of the evidence that you've heard.
He then explained the legal requirements of a murder conviction, covering the wicked intention to kill or wicked recklessness.
So I turn now to my fourth chapter, and that is the route to verdict. What I want to do now is to set out for you the route which you would require to follow in order to convict Dr. Harrison of charge 4, that is the murder of Dr. Brenda Page. I will then discuss the position of the accused.
He repeated the two points they needed to establish in order to convict. The first being, was she murdered? And he said he didn't believe that was disputed by the defence.
The critical question for you, ladies and gentlemen, is the second question. Namely, has the Crown proved, beyond a reasonable doubt, and on corroborated evidence, that it was the accused, Dr. Christopher Harrison, who committed this crime? In relation to this second question, the Crown case is entirely circumstantial. In his address to you, which I'm not going to rehearse, the Advocate Deputy submitted that based upon all of the strands of circumstantial evidence which you had heard, you should be satisfied that Dr. Harrison murdered Dr. Page. I have touched upon already the nature of circumstantial evidence and how you should go about assessing it. It's important that you examine all of the strands of the evidence with care and consider whether the evidence upon which the Crown relies on in proof of its case is credible and reliable, and whether it does satisfy you of guilt beyond reasonable doubt on the charge. The accused set out his position in respect of the charge in evidence. As I understood his evidence, his position was that he had never been violent to Dr. Page, and he had certainly not assaulted her on the night of the 13th and 14th of July 1978. He had been kind, considerate and gentle to her in general, and his evidence was that he had not seen Dr. Page on that evening. He was emphatic that he had not murdered her. Now, if you accept Dr. Harrison's position, or if it raises a reasonable doubt, you would acquit him of the charge. In his speech, which you heard yesterday, and which again I will not rehearse, Mr. McConachie raised a series of issues which he said gave rise to a reasonable doubt as to the guilt of the accused. If there is any piece of evidence from wherever it comes which you accept and which raises a reasonable doubt about the accused's guilt, then you must acquit.
He said he wasn't going to go over any more of the evidence as it was up to the jury to decide.
So I turn now, finally, to Chapter 5, namely directions as to how you should approach matters in the jury room. In your deliberations, you will have to examine all the evidence in the case, both for the Crown and for the defence, and the submissions made both by the Advocate Deputy and Ms. McConachie. There are three verdicts open to you in respect of the charge: guilty, not guilty, and not proven. The latter two, that is, not guilty and not proven, are both verdicts of acquittal. Both mean that the accused cannot be tried again on the particular charge unless in exceptional circumstances.
The not proven verdict, as some of you listeners will be aware from the previous series, is unique in Scotland. It's highly controversial, because although the accused is cleared in court, it's essentially saying, we think you might have done it, but we don't think there's enough evidence. The third verdict disproportionately impacts survivors of rape. Between 2018 and 2019, 40% of acquittals in rape cases were not proven verdicts. Lord Richardson told the jury there could be a unanimous or majority verdict, but the majority had to be at least 8 of them. He said they could choose to delete parts of the charge as long as it still included the crime of murder. He instructed them to pick a spokesperson who would deliver the verdict when the time came.
The last thing I need to tell you is that I can take your verdict from you at any time, but equally you should feel under no pressure of time. You have as much time as you require. So with thanks for your attention, will you now please retire to consider your verdict? Thank you very much.
At 11:04 a.m, the 8 men and 7 women picked up their folders full of notes and their pens and shuffled out of the jury box to the door at the back of the court, to the right of the judge. The jury room is located along a private corridor that the public don't have access to. All eyes in the press bench were analysing the faces of the jurors and then flashed over to the 82-year-old in the dock. He was wearing a brown tweed jacket, greenish-blue jumper, navy trousers and a checked shirt. His presence had become so familiar, normalised by the physical close proximity over 3 weeks.
Court.
If the jury took long enough to require a lunch hour, this could be Dr. Harrison's last opportunity of freedom.
Just stepped outside to record this. It's approaching 2 hours since they retired to consider their verdict. We've all been huddled in a sort of glass waiting area. And there's a sort of palpable tension, anxiety. I'm feeling quite sick, my chest feels tight. Everyone sort of rushes to the bathroom as soon as we're let out, because anything beyond half an hour, you think there's a potential that they could come back. We're waiting for a ring to go off to announce whether or not it's going to go back for the verdict, or if it's not the verdict, that they might have a legal question, or they might just announce that they're going to have their lunch break. But yeah, I thought they'd be back by now. I kind of estimated it'd be an hour and 15, an hour and a half. But maybe there is some discussion, some disagreement going on. It might not be over their belief of the suspicion of his guilt, but it might be about the legalities beyond reasonable doubt, which was repeated so many times this morning by the judge.
They did take the lunch break. The telltale trolley of sandwiches was spotted. Technically, this hour isn't included in the deliberation time, but I imagine it would be impossible to not be thinking or speaking about it. At 2:30 p.m, half an hour after the end of the lunch break, we heard this.
In the High Court of Justiciary, in Court Number 1, His Majesty's Advocate against Christopher Harrison, in Court Number 1, this is a verdict.
The Tannoy announcement we'd been waiting for.
I could barely hear it over the announcement, but it definitely said verdict. Yeah.
The tension went up a notch as we all made our way back up the stairs to Court 1. Journalists, lawyers, members of the public, the accused, and Brenda's nephew and his wife, who'd maintained a low profile attending parts of the trial. 2.5 hours of deliberation, plus an hour for lunch, and then we had to wait another 7 minutes for the jury to come back into court and sit down. I'm going to let you hear in real time what happened next.
Okay.
This is the point where the judge comes back in and we all stand until he's seated. And then the jury files back in. I was desperately trying to read their faces. This is the part that always feels like an eternity. And then we wait. My heart was pounding, my chest tight. Papers shuffle, pens click, breaths are held, and then finally.
Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I understand that you've reached a verdict, Mr. Scott.
Members of jury, will the spokesperson please stand? Sir, can I ask you, first of all, have you agreed upon a verdict?
We have.
What is your verdict in respect of the accused, Christopher Merlin Harnett Harrison, of charge 4 on the indictment?
Guilty.
Can I ask, is your verdict unanimous or by a majority?
By a majority.
Do you have any deletions to make to the charge?
No deletions.
Thank you. Have a seat, please, sir. Members of the jury, I now have to record the verdict. I'll just be a few moments in doing so.
I'll let you hear that again from my microphone.
What is your verdict in respect of the accused, Christopher Merlin Harlot Harrison, of charge 4 on the indictment?
Guilty.
Can I ask, is your verdict unanimous or by a majority?
By a majority.
You can hear the emotion.
Do you have any deletions to make to the charge?
No deletions.
But what you can't see is the tears.
Members of the jury, I now have to record the verdict. I'll just have a few moments in the news.
And not just for me.
Members of the jury, is your verdict correctly recorded as follows, and if so, please nod in agreement. The jury by majority find the accused, Christopher Merlin Harnett Harrison, guilty of the crime of murder as libelled on charge 4 on the indictment. Thank you.
I'm stopping here. There's a lot more to come, and I want you to absorb that verdict fully before you hear what happens next. There were so many realities going on in parallel. An 82-year-old in the dock contemplating his fate. A family who'd all but given up hope, overwhelmed with emotion. 15 strangers looking at the old man whose life they just altered. 2 teams of lawyers, one relieved, the other dejected. And people like me, invested professionally and personally, taking in the fact that 45 years on from a brutal murder, more years than I've been alive, the man responsible has been found guilty. In the next episode of The Storyteller Naked Villainy, Kit Harrison's fate is spelled out in court.
There is every likelihood he will die in custody.
The judge sentences the 82-year-old killer.
As a result of your senseless act of violence, you brought the life of Dr. Brenda Page to a brutal and premature end.
And the man leading the reinvestigation criticises the focus on Brenda's work as an escort.
I mean, it still taints it because we're speaking about a woman's private life 45 years later that has absolutely nothing to do with her murder.
If you've enjoyed this episode, please rate and review, as it makes a huge difference to guiding people to hearing this important story. This is an entirely independent production, and your support is greatly appreciated. And if you want to hear exclusive interviews, longer episodes and insights, please head to the Patreon. The link is in the show notes. Thank you again for listening. This is a piece of history, and you are, for the first time in this format, witnessing justice being done.